Chapter 6. The Patterson Years. And there appeared a great wonder in heaven, a woman clothed with the sun. Revelation. 1853. Before the date set for the wedding, Mary again became ill. On the 29th of April, she wrote to Daniel, "I am sick. Wednesday afternoon, my illness increased. My only relief is to take morphine, which I so much disapprove. My sufferings are at times extreme. I do want to see you. I know not what this attack may result in, but one thing I pray, that it may be divine will that I am not to languish out months on a sick bed. Nevertheless, not my will, but thine be done." A few days later, she had found relief, in a manner, that she did not disapprove. A cousin, Dr. Alpheus Morrill, had counseled her as to the use of homeopathic medicine, which was becoming very popular in America, and she felt that she was recovering. Daniel was dabbling in homeopathy and had the utmost confidence that he would be able to cure Mary of the diseases which had plagued her life. So on the 21st of June, still suffering from ill health, Mary was united in marriage to Daniel Patterson in a simple ceremony in her father's home. The Pattersons settled in Franklin and soon bought a house. Daniel exchanged his horse for a cow, indicating an established rather than an itinerant dental practice. But he was not willing that George should come to live with them. Mary's health did not improve, and she, rather than Daniel, became the student and practitioner of homeopathy. She practically memorized JAR, from aconitum to zincum oxidatum, and had a good deal of success in curing others. She has related some of her experiences in science and health. As for herself, although she still suffered, homeopathy relieved her of the necessity for drugs. In an interview with a newspaper correspondent in 1901, she said, quote, "I was a sickly child. I was dosed with drugs until they had no effect on me. The doctors said I would live if the drugs could be made to act on me. Then homeopathy came like blessed relief to me." End quote. After her discovery of Christian Science in the early years of her metaphysical practice, she had this to say: "From aconitum to zincum oxidatum, all through the 260 remedies of the jar, I could give the general symptoms, characteristic peculiarities, and moral symptoms to which each medicine was applied. And this helped me as a pharmacist, for when I shook the paper or the bottle that contained the drug 30 times in preparing it and retained but one drop of the original tincture to 100 drops of prepared alcohol 30 times, I was thinking 30 times of what that remedy ought to cure. The result was I got more metaphysics than physics into the dose. Hence, the potency of the higher attenuations and their increasing efficacy as matter disappeared, and mind went into the medicine. I would attenuate aconitum until it was no longer aconite, but sugar of milk. And this self-same sugar, named aconite, would at once allay febrile symptoms, reduce the pulse, and promote powerful perspirations. The highest attenuation I ever reached in homeopathy was not to medicate the sugar of milk, and with this harmless dose, I cured an inveterate case of dropsy. This was my last material medicine. I then took a step forward, not from matter to mind, but from mind to mind. For I had learned that homeopathy was the stepping stone to metaphysics. If only homeopathy would say there is nothing in a name, and mind is more potent than milk coagulated. Here is a figure. I never thought of it before. The infancy of metaphysical healing was at a period of milk, when the poison was going out of remedies, and mind was coming into them. In her later writings, she said, "Homeopathy is the last link in material medicine. The next step is mind medicine. And metaphysics, as taught in Christian Science, is the next stately step beyond homeopathy." Mrs. Patterson's practice of homeopathic medicine had only its beginning in Franklin, for they were there less than 2 years. It is probable that her longing for her son induced Daniel to move to North Groton. He enjoyed consulting with his affluent, socially prominent relatives in Sanborton Bridge, and most likely had their understanding and cooperation where Mary and George Glover were concerned. At any rate, Martha Pillsbury held the mortgage on the home, which Daniel purchased in North Groton. The new homestead included a sawmill, which Daniel intended to operate as the small town could not support a dentist full time. For this supplementary work, he also acquired 100 acres of timberland. The biggest disappointment was George. He had had very little schooling, and his lack of academic education was a blow to his mother, the most scholarly of the studious Bakers. To his stepfather, he was as great a trial as he had been to his grandfather. Before long, Daniel forbade him in the house. Myra Smith, who worked for Mrs. Patterson in North Groton, recalled in later years, "Mrs. Patterson came there with the doctor to be near her child, and so that she could teach him, but this she was not permitted to do, as the doctor did not like children and would not allow him to come to the house. The boy was not liked by the other children at school, and the Cheneys did not make him go. My brother was working for Mr. Cheney, and while there, he and the boy slept together. My brother did not like him because he was rough and would not mind anyone." Mrs. Patterson grieved and worried because she could not see her child, and told the doctor that she had given up her folks and had come off up there with him, and that she must see her boy and teach him, but Patterson would not let him come near. And without her knowing it, one day the Cheneys moved away, out west, and took the boy with them. And before they left, my father had a hard fight to get the money from him that he owed to him for my brother's year's work. It is only fair to state that after George Glover's death, his daughter said that as he grew up, he wanted to go to school, but Cheney insisted that he work on the farm instead. This, however, was probably in Minnesota, rather than North Groton. George was not Daniel's only concern. He was improvident and was not able to pay Martha the interest due on the mortgage, which in turn caused her financial problems. On the 27th of April, she wrote to her brother for advice. Dr. Patterson is unable to pay me a dollar of interest this spring, so I have to call on Mr. Tilton to pay all my debts, and they are pretty heavy. What shall I do? Foreclose at once? I suppose I can do this, as he has broken his obligation by not paying annual interest. Mary has been sick several months, and I expect they are brought to absolute want. The Tiltons, too, were experiencing economic difficulties, for their mill had burned to the ground in December of 1855. The next few years were not easy for them financially while they were rebuilding. But it has been assumed that Daniel appealed to Mary's family in San Borton Bridge for help, and that they provided the funds for the Cheneys' move to the West. Everyone except Mary seems to have known about it. She wrote in Retrospection and Introspection, "A plot was consummated for keeping us apart. The family to whose care he was committed very soon removed to what was then regarded as the far west. After his removal, a letter was read to my little son, informing him that his mother was dead and buried. Without my knowledge, a guardian was appointed him, and I was then informed that my son was lost." Her concerned family thought that Mary suffered from seeing her son, but how little they understood the mental anguish and physical suffering that would result from this final separation. When Abigail went to North Groton to visit Mary the following spring, her report distressed everyone. Martha Pillsbury wrote to George's wife, Martha Rand Baker, on the 6th of June, "Abby's visit to Mary has been constantly before my mind. I long to hear the particulars in a letter from her. I hope it will not make dear Abby worse, though such a picture of suffering and misery is enough to break a sister's heart. But Mary, poor child, alas, what words can express her condition? Everything is not compared to that. 1 year and a half confined to her bed, and perhaps now there is not even a hope that she will ever be able to rise again. Though how long life may last, God alone knows." The The want of health was Mary's one concern. Only those who have experienced severe physical suffering know the true value and meaning of health and the spiritual longing such suffering induces. Little wonder Mary would write in Science and Health, "Did the careless doctor, the nurse, the cook, and the brusque business visitor sympathetically know the thorns they plant in the pillow of the sick and the heavenly homesick, looking away from earth? Oh, did they know? This knowledge would do much more towards healing the sick and preparing their helpers for the midnight call than all cries of Lord, Lord." Yet her spirit was not quenched by her bodily suffering. In the spring of 1857, she pasted into her scrapbook a poem entitled Consolations, which included the following stanza, beside which she wrote, "Mine, April 5th, 1857. My childhood knew misfortune of a strange and weary kind, and I have always worn a chain, though not upon my mind. And I render thanks to Thee, O God, from my prison that I live, unshorn of that best privilege which Thou alone canst give. I mean a soul to apprehend the beauty that is spread above me and around me and beneath my feeble tread. And though bereft of freedom in the body, I can fly as high as heaven on wings of thought, like an eagle to the sky." Her thought did fly like an eagle to heaven, hungering and thirsting after spiritual reality. But her increased spirituality tended to increase the gap between Mary and those around her. She was sincerely interested in other people, but oh, so alone. These lines, marked in a poem she pasted into her scrapbook, give an indication of her aloneness. The poet sadly sighed, "Expect no song of pride, lady, from me, no glad and bright revealings. I occupy alone an intellectual throne. My shrinking subjects will not let me love them. Even my kindred learn in trembling awe to turn from the kind gaze of him who towers above them." Because of her intellectual and spiritual superiority, she was criticized and sometimes disliked by some of the rural rustics. But those true discerners of character, the children, loved her and sought her company. After world fame found Mrs. Eddy, many were the reminiscences of those who had been children when she was Mrs. Patterson in North Groton, and they were all fond recollections, similar to Sarah Chard's. She was very fond of children. My little sister Nettie and I used to go and play in her house, and Mother used to leave us with Mrs. Patterson for half a day sometimes when she went to the village. Days when Mrs. Patterson was not up around, she used to lay on a couch, which had a headboard that could be raised or lowered. When she was laying down, she used to tell us to take the string and pull her up. The string would fall back, Then she would lie and laugh at us and tell us to try it again. Days when she was able to sit up, she would take my sister on her lap, and I would stand beside her and she would talk to us. I don't remember what she told us, but I guess it must have been good. We always wanted to come back. Not only small children, but the teenage young people loved her. These she tutored in their academic studies, particularly young Daniel Kidder from the neighboring farm. As an elderly man, when he recalled the following, his eyes filled with tears. She was a fine-looking woman, intellectual and stately in appearance. She kept her house in the most perfect order. She wrote for the magazines of the day, mostly poetry. This was a source of much interest and pleasure to me. Mrs. Patterson took a great interest in the education of the young then living near her. She was a great help to me in my studies at that time. I remember her as a sincere friend. The Patterson's house was on a noisy creek in the White Mountains and was a delightful summer home. But the winters there were long and harsh and bleak. Mary's hours were made even longer by loneliness, for Daniel was often away for days at a time. She had occasional days when she felt she might recover, but they were few, and her days of weakness and suffering were many. One day, Myra Smith broke her bottle of homeopathic pellets when accidentally knocking them to the floor. Mrs. Patterson told her not to mind, because they were no good anyway. Her faith and hope in homeopathy had dwindled, for though she often helped others, she found no lasting improvement for herself. Her Bible was her only refuge and solace. At this dark period of earthly experience, Mary turned unreservedly to God and vowed a vow, as had Jacob. She gave the promise to God that if he restored her health, she would devote her future years to helping sick and suffering humanity. There truly appeared a great wonder in heaven, a woman clothed with the sun. Jesus had foreseen the emergence of woman and prophesied to John of this event before the end of the first century. But it was nearly 1800 years before such a woman appeared. Long after 1866, Mrs. Eddy put her initials to the statement of the above-mentioned vow, with the further statement that she had kept it faithfully. It was 7 more years till the time of her great discovery, but her ministry to suffering humanity truly dates from the time of her vow to God. From the nearby village of Rumney, Mrs. Smith brought her daughter, whom she feared was blind. In Mrs. Eddy's own words, "In the 50s, Mrs. Smith of Rumney, New Hampshire, came to me with her infant, whose eyes were diseased, a mass of inflammation, neither pupil nor iris discernible. I gave the infant no drugs, held her in my arms for a few moments, while lifting my thoughts to God. Then returned the babe to her mother healed. In grateful memory thereof, Mrs. Smith named her babe Mary and embroidered a petticoat for me. I have carefully preserved that garment to this day. 1902. Mary's life soon began to change for the better, albeit very deep waters preceded the new conditions. Improvident Daniel had mortgaged everything, even his wife's personal belongings, including her dictionary, and still had not paid Martha a cent. Probably all the family felt that Daniel might do better elsewhere, and that it would be better for Mary to move to a new location, and for Martha to have her money. In her notebook on the 20th of September, Mary wrote, "On this day, my sister sells our homestead." A neighbor noted in his diary that Dr. Patterson had had an auction on that date. A month later, the same neighbor recorded, "Dr. Patterson sold out today," probably referring to some of his other holdings. No reason is given for Daniel's procrastination, but he was still occupying the house the following February when he was assaulted while splitting wood by two men, a father and son, Joseph and Charles Wheat. When Mary rushed upon the scene from her sickbed, the younger Wheat had felled and stunned Daniel with the axe. With unwonted strength, she seized the young man and prevented his dealing the death blow. When help arrived, she had to be carried back to her bed. The newspaper account, entitled "Female Bravery," described how she had saved her husband's life. She had also prevented the Wheats from being murderers, although they were not grateful at the time. Abigail came on the 19th of March to drive Mary to a boarding house in Rumney, 6 miles distant. As soon as they departed, the Wheats took possession of the Pattersons' property. Mary wept bitterly all the slow journey, but rather typically, Daniel was absent. The depths of despair which Mary had experienced during the Groton years caused her to write in retrospect, quote, "God had been graciously preparing me during many years for the reception of this final revelation of the absolute divine principle of scientific mental healing," end quote. And for her hundreds of thousands of children that she is awakening to the glory of being, she wrote, quote, "Remember, thou canst be brought into no condition, be it ever so severe, where love has not been before thee, and where its tender lesson is not awaiting thee. Therefore, despair not, nor murmur, for that which seeketh to save, to heal, and to deliver will guide thee, if thou seekest this guidance."